The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good morning, everyone. So I'd like to begin by reading what I think is a very powerful statement that the Buddha made, and then provide you with a context for this statement. So he was talking to a group of people who were perplexed by the fact that there were many religious teachers wandering around India, in their area of India, who had very different teachings, each of them claiming that their own teaching was true and everyone else was false. So they were perplexed. And so the Buddha showed up in town, one more of these wandering teachers. And a reasonable question to ask was, rather than what is your teachings, interesting question would be, well, how do we decide between all of you guys, all you people? You know, which one is true and which is not true? So maybe the ancient Indian world wasn't as religiously diverse as the modern world, but we also live in a very diverse world, and many claims, many religious claims of all kinds. So here's this radical statement in response. Do not go by oral tradition or by a teaching lineage or by common talk or by scripture, by logic, by intuition or reasoning, or by reason of the competence of the speaker, or because someone is one's own teacher. That's phenomenal. So do not go by oral tradition. It was this pre-literary time of India, so there was no books back then, so it was all oral tradition. And what it meant is kind of the scriptures were the oral tradition, the ideas, the teachings were passed down orally from person to person. Do not go by oral tradition, by a teaching lineage, particular group like a sect, perhaps. Common talk, you know, the convention where people are talking about. Everyone's talking about that, so it must be true. Scripture, that's a pretty powerful one, given they have religions based on scripture. And then logic. Some people rely on their logic. It has to make sense. So if you're not going to go by logic, then what? Intuition. Some people love their intuition. They think their intuition is going to guide them. And the Buddha says, don't go by intuition. And then connected to maybe logic, reasoning. Maybe reasoning isn't always logical. Or by reason of the competence of the speaker. So I don't know what you think of me speaking here, but saying all this, but just because I say it, or because someone is one's own teacher. So this is a very famous teaching that was given to a group of people named the Kalamas. And the discourse is called the Kalama Discourse, the Sutta to the Kalamas. And one of the early times when I learned about this was the sutta many years ago was from a Zen teacher named Yvonne Rand. And she's been a Zen teacher now for probably over 50 years, one of the senior teachers in the Zen tradition in America. Wonderful woman. And she had been through all kinds of scandals in Buddhism. Not that she was scandalous, but that she kind of, her own center went through its scandals, and she was a go-to person that many people went to for support from other Zen groups, Buddhist groups around the country, because she was very wise about challenges and difficulties. And she said that every Buddhist should have this statement tattooed on the inside of their eyelids. Because she felt it was so important, and she had seen how many people had gone astray in the practice because they believed, they based their life on one of these criteria, one of these sources of authority. So I think it's easy to see how this idea is very challenging to many people, because their whole religious life, perhaps, or spiritual life, can sometimes be based on some external authority or some internal authority in terms of one's own logic and reasoning and intuition. And so what does it leave you with? One of the most common ways that people explain the rest of the scripture is the Buddha then said, just rely on your own experience. Trust your own experience. And he didn't say it that way, and that's probably too naive, because the word experience is way too vague. And people will often call on their experience as a source of authority, not realizing how much so-called experience is already an interpretation, already an overlay of beliefs that go into that experience we're having. And some of that, those beliefs are almost subconscious, very deep. So it could seem like my experience is true, but, you know, it's not, you know, maybe it isn't. So not a quite appropriate example, but I like it a lot. You could go out to the coast here in California and have an experience of watching the sun set. And it's beautiful, and you can write beautiful things and take pictures and take videos to have proof. Look, there's the sun is setting. And you have your own experience. But the sun is not setting. The earth is spinning backwards. The sun is pretty stationary. It doesn't move compared to the earth. And it's going. We're spinning backwards at tens of thousands of miles an hour. And lucky we don't fall off. Because we kind of use our own perspective as being, you know, the place to stand, the stationary place, it looks like the sun is setting, is moving, but it's not moving at all. So to have our own experience is a little bit, you know, you have to be careful about how to do it. And so then the Buddha was careful in offering ways that you can rely on your own experience. And he did not leave out the role of other people. And all these criteria here, I don't believe he's saying don't use them at all, but don't only depend on this. Don't let this be the last word. But all these things are useful. Listening to a teacher, reading scripture, all tradition, what people say on the streets, whatever. It all can have its usefulness. You don't want to shut yourself off from them. But then you have to be wise about how you use them, how you apply them, and how you, more important than applying them, how you test them out for yourself to find out if this really works. The question then is, works for what purpose? So here's the next section of this, teaching to the Kalamas. So he does say, when you know for yourselves, but then it goes on, when you know for yourselves that, here's the qualification, right? When you know for yourself that, these qualities, these actions are skillful, these are blameless, these qualities are praised by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to welfare and to happiness. Then you should engage in those and stay with those. Similarly, he says, these qualities, when you know for yourselves that these qualities are unskillful, these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are criticized by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to harm and to suffering, then you should abandon them. So the last thing, whether it leads to harm or to suffering or to welfare and happiness, is a fundamental criteria that Buddha uses for using your own experience. So as you engage, and the word here is qualities, dharmas, as you engage in certain mental qualities, certain activities and actions in your life, look and see what the results are. Look and see the effect those have on you. And if those lead you to feel happier, more peaceful, you feel like it brings you welfare in the appropriate way, then do them. But if they don't, if they lead to your harm, then don't do them. But even that can be a little bit, you know, misguided, because I could think that it something leads to my welfare and happiness that causes harm to other people. I could be misguided in how I understand what brings me benefit. So there are these other things, criteria. it does say these qualities are blameworthy or these qualities are blameless. So there is some ethical determination that goes into this. And I think blame and not blame in this ancient world refers to whether it causes harm to anyone at all, for self or to others, or if it does not cause harm to others or to oneself. And regardless of what you think about this word blame, I don't know if that's a good English translation, there's a criteria of criticism or evaluation or concern about what other people think about us. Not neurotically, which I had to overcome in my early years of Buddhist practice, but wisely. I mean, the fact that other people have perspectives that we don't have, and to be open to hear their perspective and say, have them tell us, you know, when you said X, I felt hurt. When you did Y, did you notice that hurt some other people? That kind of, you know, admonishment, or I don't know what the good word is besides blame. In English nowadays, we talk about feedback. Sometimes I think I'd rather be blamed than get feedback. Are you open to some feedback? So we know what's coming then. But there is, you know, it's one of the important qualities of a practitioner the Buddha talked about is the openness to get direction, the openness to be admonished, the willingness to not be so closed and defensive that no one can give you any feedback or can't avoid that word anymore. Maybe we should. And then you should be concerned about what the things that the wise criticize and the wise praise. Wise people are not 100% wise. So, but finding people you think are wise and hearing what they have to say and their suggestions and what they think is useful, not useful, is a wonderful shortcut to having to figure it out 100% by yourself. I mean, it's kind of unfortunate to kind of reinvent the wheel. So, you know, we have for now thousands of years of human beings who have been cultivating wisdom and learning, and we have people around who've been practicing for many, many years. And so to be open to, interested in what their guidance is certainly part of the tradition, but not blindly. And this is where we have to kind of then take what we hear and then test it for ourselves. Does this work for me? Does this lead to welfare and happiness, or does it lead to suffering? I've known many Buddhist practitioners who have devoted themselves very beautifully and sincerely to Buddhist practice, but have heard what their teachers had to say, heard what the Buddhist tradition had to say, and have latched on a little bit too narrowly, too devotedly, at the expense of paying attention to other things, and caused harm to themselves. And so, you know, they're not paying enough attention to the stress that might come. This happens in particular for people who go and end up living in Buddhist centers or volunteering a lot at Buddhist centers, where they somehow feel, in Buddhism, it's often an idea you're supposed to be a little bit altruistic, be helpful and supportive and generous. And people can do it sincerely enough, but do it to such a degree that they don't pay attention to the effect it has on them. And so, you know, they're just getting exhausted or stressed out or by it all. I like to say that too many Buddhist activities, doing too many Buddhist activities is un-Buddhist. Because, you know, just you get imbalanced if that's all you're doing all the time. So then he goes and gives an example of doing this kind of testing that we're meant to do for ourselves. And it's very interesting, the criteria he uses for this test is, again, for welfare and for harm. And but the questions he asks, I think, are very key Buddhist questions, the kind of key questions that orientation or perspectives in which Buddhism, you know, tests or looks at our activities in life. And so the Buddha says, "What do you think, Kalamas?" When lust, let's see here. What do you think, Kalamas? When lust arises in a person, does it arise for welfare or for harm? And there's no pronouns in that. You know, does it when lust arises in your life, in your mind, is that for your welfare or harm? It's just harm or benefit. And I think it's very important there's no pronouns, because we want to keep our attention open 360 degrees, not only to how it harms ourselves, but the world around us. We're social beings, and we're not really that separate from others as well. So to harm others, we harm ourselves. To harm ourselves, we harm others. So take care of both. And so these Kalamas answer that when greed arises, it arises for harm. It causes harm. And the Buddha says, and this lustful person, greedy person, overcome by lust, the mind possessed by lust, kills living beings, takes what is not given, goes after another person's spouse, tells lies, and induces others to do so likewise, all of which is for long-term harm and suffering. So this is kind of an extreme end of how you can harm yourself. But there's, you know, you can do a lot of harm doing much less. And then he goes on to say, now what do you think, Kalamas, when hostility arises in a person, does it arise for welfare or for harm? And they say, when hostility arises, it causes harm. And then he kind of says the same thing for hostility, that gives an example. With hostility, people harm others, killing, stealing, lying, and so forth. And what do you think, Kalamas, when delusion arises in a person, does it arise for the welfare or for harm? And they say, for harm. And then he says the same thing. When people are deluded, they ended up, in extreme versions, killing each other, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, or sometimes encouraging other people to do that too. So then, when they say yes, the Buddha then says, so what do you think, Kalamas? Are these qualities, lust, hostility, and delusion, are they skillful or unskillful? It's a very important term in the teachings of the Buddha. It's probably one of the most common terms about how to evaluate your behavior. Is it skillful or unskillful? It stands in contrast to people who say, is it good or bad? You know, rather than good and bad, is it skillful or unskillful? Is it useful or not useful? Is it helpful or not helpful? And they say, when those lust, hostility, and delusion arise, it's unskillful. Is it blameworthy or blameless? It's blameworthy. Is it criticized by the wise or not? Oh, it's criticized by the wise. And when you engage in these things, do they lead to harm and to suffering or not? And they say they lead to harm and suffering. And then he goes through the same questions for the opposite. And And the way that the Pali language, the ancient language, works, he says literally opposite by adding the negative prefix to each of these. In English, it becomes the lack of lust, the lack of hostility, and the lack of delusion. However, in the ancient language, the negative of a statement, of a word, implies the opposite. So the opposite of lust is usually seen to be generosity. The opposite of hostility is love, and the opposite of delusion is wisdom. Is it loud enough to speak, or should I speak? Okay. Okay. And then he goes through the same thing. He says, do these opposites, are they for your welfare or the harm? And he kind of, they go through the same kind of sequence. Those lead to your welfare. Each of those. So non-lust, non-hostility, non-delusion lead to your welfare. And if they lead to your welfare, then those are things that you should engage in. So this idea of following your own experience becomes more nuanced in his teachings. You want to follow that which causes harm, avoid what causes harm, and do what brings welfare. You want to listen to what other people's advice and suggestions are, the wise people. You want to look at it carefully, especially with the criteria of the motivation behind your actions. And if in some way or other the motivations have to do with greed, hatred or delusion, lust, hostility, and delusion, or the opposite, that gives you a good sense of what direction it's going to go. It's going to be harmful or not harmful. So then the Buddha does an interesting shift in the conversation. And remember, there's a kind of a social aspect to Buddhist teachings. To only explore what is true for me without any concern for the world around you would not be kind of what the Buddha was pointing towards. And that's why I think this modern, at least in California, expression that some people use, my truth. This is my truth. When it first started being used popularly, I think it probably was had a lot of wisdom to it. It's like really tuning into yourself. But as I heard more and more people using it, I got a sense that the conversation was finished. And so it's like kind of like a defensiveness or kind of a hardness or kind of like, this is it, you know, like just, I'm not budging. This is my truth and you can have your truth and, you know, and we'll go our ways or something. And so this kind of criteria the Buddha is using is a way of testing our so-called truth. Finding out, is it useful? Is it helpful to have it? And I think sometimes I listen to people talk about my truth and I listen, I don't think it's useful either what they're believing or how they're holding on to their belief. So again, looking, what is the consequence? Do I get more closed and tight? Is it harmful for me? Or is it really beneficial to how I hold my beliefs? Does it support me and help me? And so anyway, this idea of closing off from other people would not be a Buddhist practice. The idea is we have a social aspect as well in our life and our consideration. And so the switch that the Buddha makes now in the conversation to the Kalamas has a social aspect to it. And that is, he said, when someone is free of lust, hostility and delusion, greed, hatred and delusion, the person pervades the eastern direction as well as the southern, western, and northern directions, like all the way around, in all directions, with a mind imbued with loving kindness, imbued with goodwill. And goodwill and loving kindness are social emotions, social attitudes that are important in Buddhism. And one of the benefits of not having lust, hatred, and delusion is then the person has access to goodwill, to loving kindness. And lust, hatred, and delusion limit the possibility of this kind of loving kindness, kindness, friendliness, that is so important in Buddhism, one of the social attitudes. And one of the reasons to really avoid being caught up in lust and hostility and delusion is because it limits our capacity for our heart to radiate in goodwill and love. So here, someone who has no longer has lust, hostility, and delusion pervades all the way around, 360 degrees, with an awareness imbued with goodwill. The person keeps pervading also upwards and downwards, all around, everywhere, in every respect, with the all-encompassing world, with an awareness imbued with goodwill, abundant, expansive, immeasurable, free from hostility, free from ill will. Isn't this a beautiful example? To have the, and this is kind of a meditative experience, because when the mind gets really undistracted, undistractable, it doesn't jump around in thoughts and preoccupations, and it has and focuses all its attention on love and goodwill, loving kindness, it can have this beautiful sense of radiance that goes out in all directions, that feels abundant, exalted. And that we have this capacity for love in this way is one of the great potentials that we all have. And here the Buddha is talking about tapping into this potential and, you know, and radiating it out. And then he says a person does the same thing with compassion. He does the same thing with appreciative joy. So having joy and appreciation of other people and their good circumstances. And the same thing with a particular kind of love that Buddhism champions, which is called equanimity. Now, when someone does this, one's mind is then free of hostility, free from ill will, undefiled and pure. And the person acquires four assurances. So here again, the testing, you know, the consequence, looking at the consequence, what are the benefits from this? And one of the benefits are four assurances. And the word assurances is a very interesting word. The Pali word is asasa. And it literally means breathing. And figuratively, it means to breathe easily. And in English, we have the expression, oh, now I could breathe easily. I can finally breathe easily, because, you know, somehow the stress, the challenge, the thing we're worried about is no longer troubling us. And now, I can have an easy breath. So the connection between breathing easy and being assured, having a reassurance, you can see that wonderful connection there. And perhaps in looking at the kind of direct experience in our body of the benefits that we can have, to feel the breath breathing itself easily, then we know we're on track for what's really beneficial for us. So when you evaluate and look at what you do and how you live, does it support you to breathe easily in a relaxed way, in an open way, a smooth way? One of the benefits of meditation practice, especially meditation on the breathing, is you get to learn the quality of your breathing. And you get to know it really well. So you get to see small little changes in your breathing, and when you get more contracted, tight, held, forceful, and when it's more easeful and relaxed. That is a fantastic guide for finding our way to what's beneficial for us. The breathing, a relaxed breathing, is kind of like a truth teller. If you follow that, if you follow your relaxed breathing, easeful breath as your guide, you'll learn about when you're doing things which are beneficial and when you're doing things which are harmful. It's a fantastic thing to tune into and pay attention to and learn from. It's a great teacher. But the Buddha said that if you do these loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity, you get one of four assurances. The first one is that you're assured the ability to live happily, contentedly, at ease in this lifetime here. That goodwill, living out of these kinds of love, just makes your life easier and nicer. And so knowing that that's the case, is reassuring, it's helpful. Even when things are rough, knowing that if you rely on love, that things tend to work out for the best. If you believe that you'll reap what you sow, if you believe in the kind of the teachings of karma, where if you do things which are harmful to people, if you do things that are based on lust and hatred, and then if you believe those bring you suffering, then if you are grounded in love, then you have the reassurance that you're not sowing future harm to yourself, creating bad karma. That's the second reassurance. The third is that if you believe both those, then you're reassured doubly, that you're going to do the things that are beneficial and you're doing the things that's going to avoid causing you suffering. And then the last one is kind of a Pascal's wager. And that is, if there is rebirth, if there is, then you're better off, then if you do, if you live based on love, then you make good conditions for your next birth. And if there isn't any rebirth, you still get the benefits in this lifetime. So you're better off betting that it's, and just in case there's a rebirth, to live well this lifetime. So they're a little bit strange, a teaching which says, rely on your own experience, don't rely on scripture and all these things, should give kind of this Pascal's wager at the end, or this idea of karma that you can't directly see in the moment. But I think that the Buddha was talking to the Kalamas. They were not his disciples and students. They were not interested in a path to liberation. They were just perplexed by all these teachings that came along. And so they weren't asking him, the Buddha, exactly for his teachings. They're asking, how can we decide for ourselves? And so he offered these criteria. And then in order to kind of move them in a good direction, he said, he talked about love, loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and how if you practice these things, that you'll find that it helps you to breathe easily. It helps you be reassured and helps you have a better life in yourself. And that's something you can experience for yourself. So the teachings to Kalama, it's a very famous discourse of the Buddha, and it offers, a fantastic challenge. It's good to be challenged, because and one of the challenges is to challenge us to look at, why do we believe what we believe? Do we believe it because of scripture, because of teachers, because someone said it, because it's just kind of like it's what everyone's saying these days, because of our reasoning, Why do we believe? And if we believe it based on those criteria, how reliable are they? Maybe you still want to believe those things. You don't have to throw them out. But then the task is, according to this kind of instructions, test them out. See for yourself whether in living by them it leads to your welfare and the welfare of others. Look and really see what the consequences are. And the fundamental criteria that Buddhism uses for finding the path to practice, or finding our way to a wise life, is not abstract philosophical ideas, is not dogma, is not even Buddhist teachings per se exactly, but rather, is it helpful or not helpful for the sake of our happiness and the happiness of others? Down to earth, practical, immediate, this life here, does it lead to happiness or not? Isn't that nice? Easier to talk about than to do. But it's a fantastic criteria, I think. So we have a few minutes, and do you have any comments about this or questions you'd like to make? Or
so everything starts from us, like loving kindness and compassion. So when it starts from us, sometime it affects others too. Suppose I am getting a parking lot here close by and somebody is waiting there. I have to park anyway, but the other person is getting affected. Like that, so many things. The parking lot, I'm just giving an example.
Yeah.
So I'm getting a parking lot close by, another person waiting behind, but I have to park. So other person getting affected and like that in situation, so many things what we get affects others.
Yeah.
So is it also kind of hurting others or without hurting others we can't gain something, you know? So
yeah. So I'm not sure I understand, but let me try, and that is that the parking situation is an interesting one. So it could be that you're the first one to the parking spot, but you see the person behind you is also looking for the parking spot, and you see the person behind you maybe has, and it's a pretty good parking spot, it's pretty close to where you want to go, but you see the person behind you I know someone who uses a wheelchair, who drives a car. And so it could be, you know, I see that person behind me. Oh, there she is. It's quite something. It used to be quite something to watch her kind of crawl out of her car, hang on to the side, get to the back, open the back, pull out her wheelchair, get in the wheelchair, and come to IMC. It was quite something to watch. So I see her. And I say, wow. I think I'd like to have her have the parking spot. That's a good one. And I know the next parking spot's going to be 3 blocks away. But I'd rather come late than to let her struggle 3 blocks in her wheelchair. And I just feel so happy to make her life a little bit easier. And I come here smiling, my three blocks, and it just makes me feel good and happy. Someone else is behind me, and is someone who's young, fit, strong, buff, maybe a bit, you know, arrogant, and you know, and they're coming up in their fancy red Maserati, and they're honking the horn like, I want that spot, you know, it's my spot, you know, I have the money to pay for it, or, you know, get out of the way. And I'm getting to be an old man now, and and I'm going to be late to come down here. People are waiting for me, and I should be here on time a little bit. You know, the manager will worry, and so I don't feel like, not only I don't feel it's helpful to the world to give the parking lot spot to that person. So I don't give it, and I don't feel bad about that at all. It's probably maybe good for the person, maybe to be a little bit frustrated. So that's one example. A third possibility is that there's only one parking space left. in the whole city. And and I'm supposed to teach to a room full of 100 people, and I'd like the person to have a spot nearby, but I have to calculate, so what's the greater good in the situation? People are expecting me to teach. It'd be kind of awkward if I don't come. It's unfortunate the person can't come and hear me teach, but if I give them the parking space, they're still not going to hear me teach. So I feel kind of sorry for the person. I feel sorry for the situation. I wish it was otherwise, but I decide to take the parking space. So there's an evaluation that goes on based on hopefully my goodwill and my wisdom of the situation and what's most useful for everyone. And the first one about, generosity, when does the generosity kick in? I mean, I used the extreme example of my friend who had a wheelchair. But what about someone who doesn't have a wheelchair and just a nice person, just a person? when is it nicer to feel better for me to park further away and walk just so someone else can enjoy a closer pace and not have this, eagerness or this strong need? I have to be the one who has to walk the shortest bit, because if I walk short to my parking spot, then I can leave here quickly, because I need to leave quickly so I can go for my walk, drive to the place where I'm going to do get my exercise for the day. I don't know, I apologize for talking so long, but does that somehow... almost helps. Would you like to ask again or get more specific, or you want to let it go now? It's good enough. Okay. Thank you. So we should stop. It's time to stop, but you can talk. You can ask me afterwards if you'd like. So thank you very much for coming, and I hope that the teachings that the Buddha gave 2,500 years ago to the town of the Kalamas is relevant today in Redwood City. Thank you.